Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively moving into February here and the shoveling of snow and all of that stuff, but you can still get a crab cake at Fadley's. They are shipping them everywhere. You can still curbside that at Lexington Market. Stop by, stop in, maybe get an oyster. Do what I did, took home some steak fish a couple weeks ago, and I'm working on some tilapia here this weekend and waiting out the shrimp for Super Bowl Sunday. Also, our friends at State Fair and El Guapo in Catonsville, always taking care of you curbside safely. My wife and I did some chicken and waffles there 2 weeks ago over at State Fair. Big shout out to Evan. Appreciate all the support there. And, of course, Mueller and Gary. Jeff Mueller joined us last month talking about the real estate here in Baltimore. Very, very important what's going on. Doing great work. Mueller and Gary Realty there for you on the internet. Don, I know this is, you know, we've talked about the reasons we create this and Baltimore Positive and Baltimore City. We always love to have the people on who are out there trying to make a difference, the elected officials here in the city.
And today we are delighted. One of the, what I'm going to call the fresh crop of elected officials. They've been on the job almost 2 months now.
Yes.
And it is so exciting to see the exciting young blood coming into the Baltimore City Council. It's our pleasure to welcome to Baltimore Positive Felicia Porter, 10th District of the Baltimore City Council. Welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Don and Nestor.
I did not do well in biology. I skated into horticulture right around 10th grade. Mueller put me into journalism, moved me to horticulture. I skated biology other than the table of elements. So we love having folks like you on.
Yeah, let me do a little dramatic read on that.
Oh, my heavens.
Councilwoman. The councilwoman holds 2 Bachelor of Science degrees, 1 in molecular biology, biochemistry, and bioinformatics, and a 2nd in general biology from Towson University, as well as a Master's of Public Health, specializing in health policy management from Morgan State University, and a Master of Science in Law from the University of Maryland School of Law. You are a student, Madam Councilwoman, or are you not?
I am. I love learning. I love learning. Ever since I was a little girl, love.
Look at all those books behind you.
where you know, before we get into all of the serious stuff in the city and the nation, Someone with that kind of educational pedigree, talk about your background growing up as a young girl, where this love for learning came from. How did Felicia become Felicia, I guess is the question.
Yeah. So as I start with young Felicia. So I actually grew up in Baltimore City. I grew up in Edmondson Village in Southwest Baltimore. And I was a graduate of Institute of Notre Dame over in East Baltimore. And so I used to catch 2 buses to go to school from Southwest Baltimore to East Baltimore.
Where'd you transfer, by the way? Because I grew up on the 23 line.
Okay,
it always said Edmondson Village.
Yes.
On the bus when, you know, but I always got off downtown because my dad would take me to the arena. We always shopped on Howard Street, you know, back in the day.
Yes.
But I never went west to Howard Street, you know, as a kid. But Edmondson Village was that place over, you know, I've been there now. I got a map and, you know, that's more Don side. It's east side, west side thing we do here at Baltimore.
Yes.
Go ahead, Felicia.
The connection was Poplar Grove. And so that's where I caught the 15 over and onto Latrobe Project. So that juncture at Poplar Grove and Edmondson Avenue.
To IND. You
know, well, mm-hmm. Brandon Scott came on when he was just the city council president, you know, back a year and a half ago. And we literally were in Lexington Market with him at Fadley's having a crab cake, doing what we do. And he talked about being in there every day of his life because that's where he transferred.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, yep.
And most of the council people, we have that similar story whereby we caught public transportation to high school. So
we want to talk about public transportation. I smile when you mentioned IND because as folks who have listened know that we've had a former Senator Barbara Mikulski on and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and both of them, of course, beam and then get very, very sad when they talk about IND closing. As a matter of fact, the Speaker had to run. She was swamped, as she always is. And her staff was sort of pulling her away. You know, we got to go. And I said to her, any final thoughts on IND? And she did 7 or 8 more minutes talking about her love for IND. Talk about your love for IND and
oh my
what you learned from the good nuns.
it made me the woman that I am today, with regard to just shattering the glass ceiling. When you are at IND, when you're in those hallways, you really feel like you can do anything and everything that you set your mind to. And so that's the legacy that is in every young woman that graduates from IND. I've seen many people in many industries from my graduating class, and also from other graduating classes, just, you know, excelling in their industry. And so we don't just have, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Barbara Mikulski. We have dynamic women excelling in every single area of industry that I know of.
Mm-hmm. When you look back, Felicia, as a little girl, because you're a young lady, and I mean, there were other kids. I mean, I know Edmondson Village well. Also, I spent a bulk of my youth at 612 Allendale Street.
Okay, I
knew he was going to throw that out.
I mean, I could get in the car right now and go to 612 Allendale Street.
Yes, I know exactly where you are.
Show you where I slept on the second floor. So I know
I was at 500 Mount Holly Street. That was my grandmother's house. Yeah, I know exactly where you are.
Did you go to movie? Were the movies still there, or you were too young?
So no, the movies were not there, but I remember. So my family is from Edmondson Village, and I remember them talking about a movies over there as well. But when I was growing up there, it wasn't there.
I used to love going down to the movies. I'd walk the back alleys up to, what is it, St. Bernadette's?
That's my home church.
There you go.
Felicia, this was last century that this happened.
It was. My brother and I would head out and go down the back alleys and go up to St. Bernadette's on Sunday.
Yeah.
If Kevin Byrne came down into this conversation, he'd say Baltimore, a town of neighborhoods.
Right,
no matter who we are, right?
Literally, it is. So, but I'm interested. Take us inside the home, because there were other kids, like there are in all neighborhoods, who didn't do well, who blew off school, who were in trouble with the cops. And there was something in your home that said, hey, school's going to matter here. Take us inside your home growing up.
Yeah, so I was actually, I started off as a behaviorally challenged child. So, you know, I know that I'm on a interview, but my mom is probably going to kill me for saying this, but I used to stand on top of the desk and scream in class all the time because I wasn't being challenged in school. And so from that point on, my mom and my dad made a point to put me in extracurricular activities, such as dance, such as cheerleading, such as Sylvan Learning Center, extra tutorials before and after school, so that I could really just stay grounded in the classroom. And as I got older, my parents realized that I wouldn't excel at my zone school, which was Edmondson High School at the time. And they opted to work extra and get multiple jobs so that I could attend private school. And once I got there, I actually worked as a my education.
Felicia, we had a little break up there. You said once you got there and then you broke up on the Zoom.
Oh, sorry. I worked as a janitor during my summers to afford my tuition. And so my educational experience is a culmination of just my parents working multiple jobs, me working during the school year and during the summer to afford my tuition, and then making sure that I kind of had a stable home life with my parents in the house as well.
It's a common theme, right, Don? I mean, like we parents, like, you know, we can't not ask you about your, tell us about your parents.
Yeah. So my mom is actually a state worker. She's been doing that for about 15 years. Before that, she was working in the banking industry and mutual funds until she got laid off. And that's how she transitioned to the state. My dad was actually a correctional officer, and he moved into the federal government about five years ago. And so he retired about 2 years ago as a federal officer.
Mm-hmm. So, exceptional parents, huh? Felicia,
we
broke up again. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
We lost Wi-Fi. We lost all of it.
No worries. I was saying my parents have always been supportive of my crazy pipe dreams, such as running for city council.
Was that always your dream? Did you talk about that at IND when you were 16?
I did. So I was actually in student government in high school, and I was in student government at Towson University as well. holding many leadership position at many leadership positions at Towson University.
Mm-hmm. Has that been a good primer for you to have done that? I mean, I kid Don about being a sergeant at arms of student council at Dundalk High. I mean, that was, you know, sort of a made up, that was a vote for Pedro job. I'm not going to lie to you, you know. But obviously, you know, the level that you took at that pathway, and you know, Don, I think we talked to Johnny O a lot about that, like mm-hmm. that there are a lot of young people out there like yourself and that older people like me are relying on now to take this stuff seriously, you know, like school and stuff that maybe I didn't take as seriously as I should have.
Well, it did. I mean, you know, some of the key policy issues that we as student government instituted at Towson University when I was there was a smoke-free campus. You know, at that time, that was like a huge thing to undertake for student government. We instituted diversity, inclusion, and equity at Towson University. And so we had racial issues when I was at Towson University, and we as a student government not only took a stand against racial discrimination, hatred of any kind, we followed it up with programming from the student government. We followed it up with introduction and development of new student groups.
It's how things get done, right? Literally.
Yeah. Yep. That could cultivate.
It's how
that.
Change so, is made.
Exactly. And that's how primed me for you know my position today, thinking critically, thinking creatively, and thinking outside of the box in very challenging situations and challenging atmospheres.
Well, Felicia, when you take this incredible background, I mean you've got all of these degrees, you've got this, you know, wonderful upbringing. You were someone who knew what you wanted to do. You were blessed in that way from a young age. So you end up back in early December. Your dream comes true. You're representing the 10th district. Tell folks a little bit about, we like to have our electeds take our listeners inside their district. Sort of give us a virtual. We're going to pretend like we're shutting our eyes and you're driving us around your district. Describe it for us.
So the District 10 is very, very, very interesting. It's kind of I would call it the forgotten district of Baltimore City. Most people don't go down in South Baltimore, but I am looking to change that. And so as we close our eyes, I'm going to take you all from Martin Luther King Boulevard all the way down to Pigtown. So Pigtown has a very rich culture of actually herding pigs. Historically, there was a slaughterhouse in Pigtown, and pigs used to actually run up to the slaughterhouse from Washington Boulevard. And so that's how Pigtown got its rich heritage, its rich cultural kind of legacy in Baltimore. Then I'll take you to Morrill Park, which historically has been one of the, you know, best places to live in Baltimore. But over the past 10 to 15 to 20 years, it has succumbed to drug addiction, substance abuse, and just a lack of efficient city services. Then I'm going to move you down into Violetville, which is one of my gems that most people in the city do not know about. It's where you have, you know, most of your families of South Baltimore. So Violetville is a beautiful, beautiful area that has wonderful homes, wonderful community, and neighbors that actually, you know, typically that old Baltimore feeling.
Little hospital around there too, right?
It is. So St. Agnes is over there as well.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And then we're going down to Cherry Hill, Westport, Lakeland, which
see, is I'm on the map right now, and all I want to do is eat in your district. So, you know, I want some kibbies, shrimp, yeah, shrimp salad. I mean, that's kibbies. Don knows, right, Don?
I'm well aware of kibbies.
Dude, you know how many fettuccine Alfredo I had at Pargo's back in the day? I mean, come on, I'm looking at the whole map over there.
Yeah. I mean, Kibbies is one of the places over near Violetville that has sustained that area. You have Reb's Candy over there as well. That is a gem of District 10. Then you're going down to more into the southern part, into Cherry Hill, Westport, Lakeland area, which is a cultural gem, particularly for the African-American community. It was a place where African-American families could exist post 1960, whereby they could live freely and cultivate their neighborhoods. And then we're going all the way down to Brooklyn and Curtis Bay and Fairfield area, which has such an industrial feeling. But there are people still down there. But that area was the main staple for like the port area. Any type of, you know, maritime business would be funneled through that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
a big district. It is.
I was just going to say, if you were knocking, of course, it was a pandemic, so you campaigned a little differently. But
oh no,
did you knock doors even in a pandemic?
24 months. I knocked doors. I knocked doors in preparation for my campaign, and so even before the pandemic, we had knocked over 20,000 doors.
Well, that was a couple pair of Nikes you went through.
Oh, yeah.
You're planning all this up at Towson, you know, right? So run us from Towson to here, from student government to real government. You know, run us through the degrees and all the schooling you've had and all that. But the practical nature of what you're trying to get done and quite frankly, the platform you ran on and where you feel like there can be change made in really, really tough times right now for everywhere with this pandemic.
Yeah. And so from Towson University, I actually started working at the Department of Defense. So I studied suicidal behavior with the Army. And so from there, I had a real good understanding of not only very sensitive subjects, but also how to convey that data into actual practical programming that can be used by departments such as Baltimore City. From there, I went to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration. And there, I got a real big life lesson about politics versus policy on Capitol Hill. And so that has allowed me to not only cultivate my relationships, but also to really know the lay of the land, the social and political climate that we were in at that time in relation to healthcare, because the Affordable Care Act was passing at that time. And so I was calling, you know, state legislators in Arkansas, and they were telling me to get lost. I was letting, you know, people in Wyoming and California.
And you want to say to those people, you
healthcare.
Have people there that live, right?
I did.
Right? I mean, people there get cancer and get sick and get old too, right? Right? I mean,
yeah. And so that was an opportunity for me to really learn how to work in very, very challenging states. And so even with District 10, most people don't know, we have a very conservative area in District 10. And so even though I'm a pretty liberal person as an individual, the constituency that I represent is fairly conservative.
Mm-hmm. You know, Felicia, that's what I love about Baltimore Positive. That piece that you just mentioned comes up over and over again. And it's always this danger, I think, of people wanting to put certain voter blocks and certain ethnicities into a box. And I can't tell you how many African-American electeds and businessmen and women over the years have said to me, Don, you've got to understand, we don't all think one way.
Yes.
And many of my friends and relatives are pretty conservative. Talk
yes.
about that dynamic, because I don't think people understand that, Felicia.
No, and you're absolutely right. I often, you know, I'm a numbers person. And so when I pull the data roll from the elections and look at, you know, how people voted, that's a clear, you know, I share that with people that, you know, even though people, you know, may say that Maryland is pretty progressive in our policy and in our electorate, it's actually not as progressive as people think. And so that's an opportunity, I think, whereby elected officials, particularly in Baltimore City, which historically has just been coined as a democratic city, we have to really drill down a little deeper to not only look at the policies and how they're affecting people instead of just looking at party status. And that's where I kind of had to hone in from my Capitol Hill experience into the city council experience.
Felicia, this is where, you know, this is why I've been like off eye with you, because I've been literally looking at this New York Times map and talking about, and I'm sharing this with our audience right now, which I don't do a whole lot of this. I probably should do more just to show the 10th, because I was looking at it as you were talking neighborhood to neighborhood, but I wasn't sharing it. And then now you're going to get drilly on me here. We are going to talk about, like, you know, how Cherry Hill votes at 93% yes. Biden, and how Morrill Park is 13% Biden. So it's very, very apparent for anyone who does the math on this. And I showed this to my wife the other day. It's kind of a new map. She's like, what about the other states? I'm like, oh, no, they're red states. They'll take months to report. But at least our reporting is there. And it really yeah. does speak to what all of us experience here and the way people think. And yeah. I don't know that I really believe that when I was talking to Orioles fans or Ravens mm-hmm. fans mm-hmm. for years and years and years. It's taken me this period, this last yeah. 5 years of awful turmoil, right, to have people mm-hmm. like you on the show to talk about these things, because I don't think they're understood by a lot of people, but they're getting more understood by more people.
They are. And I think the previous election, really showed two major data points that kind of threw people for a loop. 55% of white women actually voted for Trump, and I believe about 20% of African-American males voted for Trump. And so you see this dynamic here whereby we were just talking about, like, if you're African-American, you're automatically assumed to vote Democrat, and that the numbers don't align with that.
Well, I'm Hispanic in South Florida. They get
and
that
also Hispanic
very, very
as
wrong.
Well. Yeah, also
Felicia,
Hispanic
what,
as well.
What was it? And I don't want you to speak for all of the African American men who voted for Trump. But if you had to go, you are a data person, you're an mm-hmm. analyst. If you had to go to 10,000 feet, mm-hmm. what was it in his message that resonated with a portion of African American men?
So I can actually clearly answer that question, because we even had some African-American men in my district when I went to door knock. They actually told me that they would not vote for me, a Democrat. They were, you know, voting a clear Republican ticket to include Donald Trump. And one of the things that they mentioned was that, you know, they felt as though one, social programming was too vast and too wide and too dependent. Number two was that they felt as though employment and job opportunities were not clearly provided for African American males in general, and so they really felt pigeonholed into taking less wages. And from a cultural perspective, African American men are seen as the leaders of the family, taking care of your family. So if you go into that cultural deficit, then you're going to feel it. And we saw that exactly with how people voted in this last election, particularly, like you were saying, Hispanic men, African-American men, and white women.
I do not represent the thoughts of Marco Rubio on behalf of any of my Venezuelan friends. I want to make that clear. Felicia Porter's here. She's representing the 10th. We're talking city council, city government, pandemic, all that stuff. Of course, Don Mohler here, as we always are on Baltimore Positive, trying to bring new voices. Don, you got so much for her. Go ahead, man.
Felicia, you mentioned there is so much, and we're going to have you back because we love the insights of those of you on the front lines making a difference. Before we get to specific city issues that you care about, and I know health and housing are near and dear to your heart, yeah. but I want to go to a part of your district again, because you mentioned Cherry Hill. Whenever mm-hmm. folks mention Cherry Hill, Nestor and I think of the success that they had with Safe Streets. Mm-hmm. And whenever we think of Safe Streets, we think of Dante Barksdale.
Yes.
And both of us really had our breath taken away recently when we woke up to the news one day that Dante had been murdered. A couple of questions. One, on the campaign trail or in your activism, did you interact with Dante? And how did you react to this tragic news?
So I was not fortunate enough to engage with Dante personally, but I engage with Safe Streets and Cherry Hill often, and also the Safe Streets in Park Heights. One of the directors there is actually a personal friend of mine, Rashad Singletary. And so I've had, you know, very kind of indirect interactions with many of the people that work in Safe Streets, including Dante. I mean, there's so many of them that are working on the front line that any one of them could be Dante. With regard to like just from a public safety perspective, in each neighborhood, that the Safe Streets is really kind of the grounding of and the grounding and bridging of that gap between the Baltimore City Police Department, public safety organizations, and community. With the murder of Dante Barksdale, there was a complete breakdown of the rapport with the community, with the public safety vision of the city and Mayor Scott, and also just a key protection, a key personal protection factor with how he was murdered. It was very, very grotesque, and it forced me to really not only just keep saying the words that we're going to fix public safety, but also admitting that we have failed in the city. We have failed. If situations continuously happen like this, we have failed. And I think we as elected officials, we need to acknowledge that. And it's cool to acknowledge, the work that we have done, but we have so much farther way to go.
Well, I want to pick up on that because as Nestor talks about often, why we wanted to do this, I think one of the things that we've heard, you've heard, the mayor's heard, we've had the mayor on 5 or 6 times. Mm-hmm. We've all heard that the city is unfixable. Oh. Nestor and I reject that. We think this city is a great city.
You know why I reject that? Because I'm a little older and I travel a lot. I've been all over the world. I've read up on Medellin getting fixed. I've seen Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Nashville, Charlotte, Detroit.
Right.
I've seen all of these places get better. And I've gone to places and I can name them, and it's not red or blue that have deteriorated, in my 25 years. And the perception of this city, as someone that got off a plane, I'm 52 now. When I was 22, it was Cal Ripken and crab cakes in the Inner Harbor and Camden Yards and Fort McHenry and, all of that. And now it's The Wire and David Simon, someone I've known forever too. But we need to lift this place, and we need people to believe in it, because I do deal with people who vote red and are out in various counties that literally say, I never coming back to the city, say they're never coming to a game. They're not going to Little Italy. They're not coming to the harbor. And I say, we'll fix it and you'll come back because it's your town too.
And you know what else I say, Nestor, when we go back to Felicia, I say to them, until you're sick, because again, just this week, I had a really good friend have a serious health issue, came on unexpectedly in, I won't mention which county, in a distant county, and was ready to head to a local emergency room. And you know what his wife said? No, you're not. We're getting in the car and we're going to Hopkins.
Yep.
And she could have as easily said, or we're going to the University of Maryland, or we're going to Mercy. So when you need serious health care, you immediately head to Baltimore.
Felicia, my wife is a cancer survivor 2 times in 2014-15. We're 1.6 miles from, she spent 155 nights on the 5th ward at Hopkins with 2 bone marrow transplants. So, this is recent times. Being close to that and being in Baltimore for your district, for all of us, we really are all in this together. And I think everybody that we voted on recently seems to be able to say in some way, we got to make this better. This isn't good enough.
So that's the jumping off point for you, Felicia. We now turn to you. Yeah. You now have the keys to the car. Mm-hmm. We all have the Baltimore stories. My 2 5-year-old grandchildren who spent a month or so in the NICU 5 years ago, turned 5 today from Johns Hopkins Children's Center. We all have these great stories.
That was beautiful cake, by the way. I want some of that cake done.
You have the keys to the car. Mm-hmm. You're now in charge. Opioids, housing, health issues, crime. Tell us how we're going to fix it. And we're going to shut up.
Yeah, no worries. So I wanted to first kind of backtrack to what you were saying about the narrative of Baltimore. So we really have got to change the narrative of Baltimore, because you both just mentioned 2 key things that I hear over and over again from people from surrounding counties, indicating that they're not going to spend a dollar in Baltimore City. They're not going to bring their families to Baltimore City. But if they have a major health crisis, they will come to Baltimore City. We have some of the best institutions here in Baltimore City. That needs to be the front facing picture of how people see Baltimore. Granted, The Wire was a nationally acclaimed, internationally acclaimed show, but it does not define who Baltimore is. Baltimore is not a city that is defined by addiction. It is not a city that is defined by drugs. You know, we have to begin to change that narrative. And that's exactly what I'm doing. You know, when I first came in on December 10th, one of the things that I shared with my team is that not only do we give exceptional customer service to the citizens of Baltimore, we got to get back to basics to get people to trust in elected leadership again. So making sure their trash gets picked up every time and on time, ensuring that potholes are filled within their neighborhood, ensuring that we have adequate lighting and speed lights work again. We've got to get back to the basics of what city government and municipalities are supposed to be doing. We have some of the highest taxes in Baltimore City. And to my knowledge, we are not living up to that. We're not living up to that respect. We have some great workers here in the city that are doing everything that they can, but they need us as elected officials to advocate on their behalf to ensure that, one, they're getting paid on time, they're getting paid their correct amounts, but then also they have the resources in order to do their job effectively and to the best of their ability. And then from there, you can build on, you know, the housing issues, the policy issues, I mean, the health issues that we're seeing all across Baltimore. But first, we got to start with the basics. Then we can really begin to look at how to build up vacant housing in neighborhoods, how to eliminate blight in neighborhoods, how to increase economic recovery post-COVID. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic has placed such restraints not only on individuals and families, but also small businesses as well. So what does that economic recovery look like? And bringing the best and brightest minds together, the best and brightest minds together that we already have in this city, that people know that we have in the city, to figure out these problems and really create actionable plans, not just plans that you just put on a website and they exist there for the nature of just publicity sake. But I'm talking about actual benchmarks. And that's exactly what we're doing in District 10. Every week, we put out how many constituent concerns that my office handles. And we actually go down to a more granular, detailed level to share with people the types of constituent concerns that we are handling in District 10. So people get a knowledge base of what you can call on the city for.
And so you should tell people how they can. I mean, that's exciting. Tell yes. folks. I think folks in your district want to know, how can they stay connected to you?
Sure. So they can actually email my office, Felicia, PHYLICIA, .Porter@BaltimoreCity.gov. Or you can follow me on all of my social media, Porter for Baltimore, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Yeah, you know, for me, with where we are, this is a chance for our country to come together in so many ways, and all the crap going on at the Capitol. And you spent a lot of time in the Capitol, or a little time in the Capitol.
No, so I spent 3 years there. And so it was very triggering for me to not only have friends still there during that time, but to know
what
that
was your day like that day? Tell us about it, because that's a 9/11 yeah, day for everybody. We always ask people that have a real association to the Capitol.
Yeah, and so it was. And ironically, because some of my constituents are my actual friends on Facebook, I noticed that they were at the Capitol as well. And so it was very interesting to see that dynamic of Baltimoreans engaging at the Capitol in this type of activity. And so my day was really not only just glued to CNN, but also glued to my social media to see people that I know had voted for me are participating in this type of activity at the Capitol. And it was jaunting for me, but it was an eye opener for me to know that, you know, not only do I represent a conservative base, but I represent people that that really have issue with government. The essence of who I am in my office as city councilwoman, they have an issue with that. And it really forced me to reflect, to think how I can still be of service to them. Because you can't just pick and choose who you're going to serve. You got to serve everybody.
Right. We've got them all, right? Yeah. Yeah. Felicia, one of the things that came up shortly after that horrific day, when Nestor and I were talking, both publicly and privately, but certainly publicly on the show with some of our African-American friends and guests, was they shared with us that one of the most difficult moments for them during that day was when they saw the Confederate flag being carried through the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I said to them very openly, I said, geez, I hate that flag and everything it stands for, but that wasn't what stuck out for me. And to me, that spoke to the African-American experience. And I was wondering if you had a similar reaction that day to the Confederate flag.
So I didn't have that reaction to the Confederate flag. I actually had a even kind of triggering reaction to the noose that was actually outside of the Capitol that was hung. So that was even more triggering than the Confederate flag. You know, I've dealt with, you know, with racism, sexism, and bigotry all of my life. So it's nothing new to me to see a symbol, like that, and be moved. But something that essentially speaks to the annihilation and the extermination of my people, such as a noose, that was even more triggering than the Confederate flag for me.
Well, you know, that is so it's interesting how, again, small to more and things come together. My wife, if people, again, have listened, they know she keeps sort of a photo album of the year month by month. And the one image that she wanted to make sure that we had a photo of was the noose. She said, you've got to get the noose, because I think that captures where we are. And for her, so she had that same visceral reaction that you did. But before we let you run and get back to the important business of running the city, you're a public health person. We're not going to have a public health person come on here and not talk about all things public health. But particularly at this time, what do we have to do to get shots in arms? And what do we have to do to start to address this racial disparity that's showing up in all of the early data, in that African Americans are being vaccinated at a disproportionately low rate? I'm sure as an expert, you've given that some thought.
Yeah. So one of the things, the first thing we have to do is to encourage people to get vaccinated. And, you know, there's a medical mistrust that particularly African Americans and minorities feel with the medical system that we have to overcome. That's something that I've been speaking with the current health chair, Danielle McCray, and also area hospitals such as Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland Medical Center, about how we are communicating the importance of this vaccine in relation to not only just the nation's public health, but our individual and family health as well. I know people are attuned with what is happening with COVID-19, but until it hits you personally in your house, many people don't make those connections. So we as public health professionals, particularly those in the communication space, have to make those connections for individuals, because it's not something that is just a you snap of the hands and people make those connections. You have to make it very plain and very visceral for people to know that this is a real threat to our nation's public health. Secondly, from a advocacy perspective, from the city health department, we have got to support our Baltimore City Health Department, which is the nation's oldest city health department. We've got to support them with resources. We got to support them with our voice, advocating to Governor Hogan to not only to increase the vaccination supply into Baltimore City, but to have a consistent vaccination supply in Baltimore City, step one and step two doses. That's very critical here. You know, I hear many people, you know, on Facebook, they're talking about, you know, we're not getting any vaccinations into Baltimore City. The Baltimore City Health Department is failing. No, that's simply a misinterpretation of who actually controls, one, the pocket, the money related to how we are getting those vaccinations from the federal government, but also how we're allocating and distributing those vaccinations to our jurisdictions within Maryland. And so Prince George's County and Baltimore City have a high population of African-American and minority communities. And for generations, we've seen that they've had diabetes, they've had cardiovascular disease, they've had COPD. So these are underlying conditions that have always been in the African-American community, and compounded with, you know, COVID-19, compounded with living, you know, in food deserts and lack of nutrition, and just lack of preventative health care. We are seeing a extended perfect storm of what is happening in public health. And these are the times whereby, back in graduate school, these are the times where we learned about and we're now actually living them. And so moving forward, when we look at the racial dynamic of how vaccines get distributed in Baltimore, not only do we have to look at a population base, but we also have to look at a chronic health outcome base. You know, where are the counties and jurisdictions in Maryland that have the highest rates of chronic disease, and begin to allocate and reallocate from an equitable perspective for those vaccines? And that's where we have to get at. That's our starting point. And we're going to be in COVID-19. We're going to be in this pandemic for a long while. Dr. Fauci, you know, to his brilliance, I mean, is projecting 2022. It's a very serious timetable that if we don't get a handle on these foundation level metrics and distribution, and making sure that we have distribution sites all across, you know, these jurisdictions, so people that I can actually get to, and keeping appointments and things of that nature, we're going to be in a very serious pickle.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you are so advanced on this. Pop-ups, I mean, I'm seeing, you know, I watch a lot of news and see stuff. And we talk so much, you know, Larry Hogan and Brandon have talked about the stadiums and stuff like that.
Yes.
But I'm thinking out in the neighborhood, you know, how is this going to work in Edmondson Village or Morrill Park?
Yeah. And so that you bring up a very good point. And that's something that, you know, the mayor has talked about on a number of occasions, is that, you know, these vaccination sites, we are not only compounded with putting these vaccination sites in centralized locations, but we also, you know, we're forced to figure out a way how to get people to these vaccination sites. So, you know, the one thing that I often caution people, if people can't get to the grocery store, which is supposed to be 1 to 2 miles in your neighborhood, how do you expect them to get 5 to 7 miles down the road to a vaccination site? So we have to think critically, and we have to use all of our industries in place so that we can solve this problem. And that's exactly what public health is.
You know, you and I grew up the same way, because my parents didn't drive, right? So, I mean, you took a bus every day of your life. Like, public transportation, they take you for granted in New York, right? We all do. We land in New York and things just happen, and we get places quickly. Doesn't work that way in Morrill Park, right?
Well, Nestor, you talked when we had, and I apologize, Councilwoman. I know we're running over.
Oh, no, you're good.
I don't want your staff to beat us up. We want you to come back.
No.
But
he does this to everyone.
I know,
I swear to
terrible.
God, he does.
We get interested in what you have to say. Nestor, you spoke, I don't know if you recall this or not, but when we had Heidi Daniel on from the Pret, you talked about, as a little boy, the bookmobile. And I guess what I'm turning to you, Councilwoman, to say, it almost seems to me, particularly in the urban areas of America,
Shotmobile,
that we may want to revisit a bookmobile and call it the Shotmobile, and literally identify neighborhoods that we're going to be coming through on a regular basis until we get people vaccinated. Any thoughts like that on a creative way from the council?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And so it necessarily wouldn't come from the council. It necessarily wouldn't come from the council. Where it would come from is using our voice on the council to challenge and inspire area hospitals to create those types of creative methods. And that's exactly what MedStar Harbor Hospital in South Baltimore, my district, has already been doing. St. Agnes, they have a pop-up clinic. University of Maryland Medical Center, I am in close contact with the community engagement manager, and they are thinking through those mobile ways whereby people can get the vaccine. But there are a few factors that you have to look at and create within this mobile unit environment. So the vaccine has to be kept in sub-zero temperatures. And so we have to create that that atmosphere on these mobiles. Number two, there has to be some sort of, you know, computerized data component whereby we're tracking whether people are on step one or step two, or if they are just new people in the frame altogether. So there are a few things that we have to think about.
I think that's what has so many excited about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that's proven 100% effective in keeping people from getting serious illness and hospitalized. I think its efficacy. I think its efficacy was 72%, which is still very high, but the 100% from serious illness, and the Johnson & Johnson evidently doesn't have to be kept at extremely cold temperatures, and it's a single dose. So the Shotmobile might work well for that. Before we let you run, any big initiatives or upcoming things on your plate that you would like our listeners to know about before we didn't ask you about?
Yeah, so particularly in my first year, as I shared before, I am all about getting back to basics. And so in District 10, we're more, you know, we're going to be connecting communities in the northern part and also in the southern part so that they feel connected to City Hall and my office, making sure that they have efficient city services, making sure that my community associations and community organizations have the technical assistance from the city to actually thrive in South Baltimore. One of the first policies that I'll be introducing is really bringing all of our small businesses together, particularly those that, you know, are truly small businesses, and figuring out a way so that we can initiate and sustain economic recovery post COVID-19. And so we're looking at resources and technical assistance for my true small businesses. Number two, I'll be introducing at probably the end of February, a small haulers collaborative. We know that illegal dumping is something that is rampant, not only in South Baltimore, but all across Baltimore. And so I'll be introducing a program that not only incentivizes small haulers to take charge and take participation of these illegal dumping areas and hotspots across the city, but also it would be a collaboration with the Department of Public Works so that they can actually work together to handle some of our huge and enormous waste management issues and sanitation issues that we're seeing in Baltimore. And I wanted to start out, I'm very academic in nature, but I wanted to start out with those practical things, those quality of life issues that, like you say, we know public safety is big. We know our transportation system is not the best. These are quality of life and basic issues that can be the teetering point of people coming back into the city from a common sense perspective.
Well, we've loved having you on. I'm going to leave it with this because, you know, Don usually asks, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be, you know, at the end, or about your baking skills or whatever. But, you know, I've done a little bit of research here, and it's up on the website that you have a special a creature in your life, Professor William Bruno Shakespeare. Yes. You know, my cat is sort of my special someone with my wife as well. So we love animals here. So I want to give you a chance to talk about your dog.
So my dog, he was actually a runaway. And so he ran to my friend's house, and his name was Henry, but he looked like Albert Einstein with the white hair. And so I named him Professor William Bruno Shakespeare. And so it combines my arts background and also my science background, my science background as well. So he is the joy of my life right now. He keeps me calm and he follows me everywhere around the house.
I thought it was Bruno San Martino or Bruno Mars. I wasn't sure. The Shakespeare part I got, so I was fine with that.
What a delightful visit. Go IND. A shout out to all those nuns that years ago saw this potential in
I'm going to do is, you and I, at some point we get this shot in the mask, we're going to get together in Pigtown, have a proper meal somewhere.
Oh,
that you're going to pick the place, and I don't need to be like Brandon plugging all these places, whatever place you want to go.
I
need to get over to Pigtown and hang out. All right.
Okay. Come on down.
Night of a thousand Elvises. I got to come out and do a bunch of stuff. All right.
Cool. It was good talking to you all.
Felicia Porter joining us here. She is our new council person over the 10th. And you can find her Porter4BMore out on Twitter. And of course you can just find her anywhere. Just go to the city, pop her name in. I found it on a Google search. You can do that as well. Don Moeller is my partner. We have been talking to Luke Broadwater and talking to all sorts of elected officials. Barry Glassman from Harford County.
Yes.
We had an incredible piece of Baltimore County lore with a whole bunch of Baltimore County executives, some actually older than Don. I know you find that hard to believe. You can find all that out in our podcast audio vault. I'm Nestor. He's Don. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Taos in Baltimore, we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.